related to cancer, for which she's received treatment four times the past two decades. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Reporting by remote, I'm Dave Berger.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, a debate over whether to open schools is raging across America, even as COVID-19 surges in several regions. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel, coming to you from my makeshift home studio in Washington. After a prolonged lockdown and shutdown of the nation's primary and elementary schools to prevent the spread of the coronavirus, it is natural that parents, children, and educators are anxious for in-person classes to resume. U.S. President Donald Trump has made returning to school a high priority for his administration. Speaking at a White House event on Monday, July 13, he suggested that those who are skeptical of reopening schools are politically motivated.
We have to open the schools. We have to get them open. And I think there's a lot of politics going along. I think they think they'll do better if they can keep the schools closed in the election. I don't think it's going to help them, frankly, but I think they feel that by keeping schools closed, that's a bad thing for the country, and therefore that's a good thing for them.
On the other hand, Val Demings, a Democratic lawmaker from the state of Florida, which has seen a dramatic uptick in COVID-19 cases, says in a recent Twitter post, "Without a strategy to safely open our schools, this administration is simply ordering parents and teachers to put themselves and their children in danger. We need a comprehensive plan from this administration and the resources to enact it." Regardless of political affiliations, most Americans want to see schools reopen, have their children return to the classroom so they do not fall farther behind academically. Children greatly benefit from in-person learning, being among their peers and teachers. Many in impoverished communities have been at a disadvantage regarding online learning. But given the resurgence of COVID-19 in several states, such as California, Texas, Arizona, and Florida, some are questioning the wisdom of opening schools without strong precautions. So joining us to discuss the pros and cons of reopening schools across the United States as we continue to navigate the COVID-19 pandemic, we have two distinguished education analysts. Scott Sargrad is a former Deputy Assistant Secretary for Elementary and Secondary Education at the U.S. Department of Education under the Obama administration. Now he is Vice President of K-12 Education Policy at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal think tank here in Washington. And Jonathan Butcher, he's Senior Policy Analyst in the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative-leaning think tank also based in Washington. Jonathan co-edited and wrote chapters in the book, The Not-So-Great Society, which provides conservative solutions to the problems created by the federal footprint in preschool, K-12, and higher education. And both gentlemen make their debut on Encounter and join me via Microsoft Teams. Jonathan Butcher from Heritage, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
And Scott Sargrad, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Butcher, let me begin with you. To reopen or not to reopen, that's a tough trade-off. By now, I think we all thought that the pandemic would be much more under control here in the United States, but now we are seeing this resurgence in many southern and western states that are causing parents and educators to pause as much as they would very much like to send their children back to school. They want to do so safely. So what is your overall take on school reopenings, even as the pandemic is surging in many states like Florida, California, and Arizona? Do you think the benefits of reopening outweigh the health risks?
Well, to begin with, I don't think that we should rely on reopening plans from Washington. They cannot possibly be specific enough to address the needs of school districts around the U.S. The plans for reopening should be done as locally as possible with educators and families as they consult local health officials and as they look at the data on what they have on how the pandemic is spreading. So I would begin there. I would say that the evidence that we have shows that young people in particular are the least affected by the virus. And I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit more in the show, but the evidence from the move to online learning, especially from some of the larger districts in the U.S., left a lot to be desired, and parents were not satisfied. And in fact, thousands of students may have been lost.
Indeed. Well, that's certainly worth looking at. Let me turn to you, Scott Sargred. President Trump and Education Secretary Betsy DeVos are coaxing schools to open and implying that if they don't, funds may be withheld. Scott, what's your take? And you could also perhaps talk about the very decentralized nature of our primary and secondary school system and how it is funded primarily, if I'm not mistaken, through local property taxes. So that also means that some schools have more resources than others. And Jonathan also brought in the point that Washington shouldn't be dictating what the local communities should do. So with all that, your take on the benefits and risks of reopening?
Well, I do find it a little bit ironic that President Trump and Secretary DeVos are the ones pushing for a federal mandate on reopening schools when Secretary DeVos has made her entire career about local control of schools. And I agree with Jonathan that these are very local decisions on how to reopen schools safely. I think there's broad agreement among educators, among doctors, among experts that we do need to reopen schools, but it needs to be done safely for parents, for children, for educators. And I think it is clear that the benefits of in-person instruction are much greater than virtual instruction, but that doesn't mean that we have to open every single school across the country when we have a pandemic raging. It means that we need to look at local health conditions on the ground. It means we need to look at things like incidence levels, transmission rates in individual communities. It means that we have to be providing resources from the federal level for things like personal protective equipment and physical distancing to meet CDC guidelines. But I do think that we really need to think about what these local conditions are and not have a federal mandate for reopening when that doesn't reflect what people really want. And I think to your question about the issues with the United States schooling system, again, I think this is something that Jonathan can speak to as well. But given that we have 50 states, 15,000 individual school districts, each run by school boards, that means that there are really local decisions that are made about how all of this works. It means that the federal government needs to step in and provide resources and can provide guidance and support. And I think we're seeing the limitations of the idea of local funding for education when we have dramatic cuts in state budgets and the resulting impacts on communities, and particularly communities where lots of families have low incomes. But there are big differences from state to state and even from school district to school district within those states.
Turning back to you, Jonathan Butcher, to continue on this point about federal mandate versus the local, what is your understanding of what President Trump and Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos would like to see? Because of this irony that Scott underscored, that in reality, the federal government doesn't have really so much control, and yet they are pushing for this. What is their vision? How do you understand what they're looking for?
Well, I can't read their minds. I would say that they are, I think, trying to give confidence to local educators that they see the value of in-person learning, and they have a large megaphone, right? The president and the administration make headlines, and they, you know, attract attention with every word they say. So I think the effort to give parents and local officials confidence is noteworthy, admirable even. Again, I don't think that there should be a mandate. There doesn't need to be one because Montana opened schools for in-person learning even before the school year ended. Idaho had some schools open even before the school year was over. Now, as we entered the summer, we had states like Illinois and Pennsylvania and even Texas opening for in-person summer school. So states were not waiting for Washington to, you know, give them permission, and that's how it should be. Look, we have 50 states. Frankly, we have 50 different pandemics, and there should be at least 50 different plans, probably more so, based on the number of districts we have, for getting kids back to an in-person situation.
Before I turn to Scott, Jonathan, does the federal government have the power to withhold funds for schools that do not want to reopen because they feel it's unsafe?
Yeah, I mean, I think that would find itself in court, probably. I'm sure there would be challenges to that based on the way that the federal education law, the ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act, is written. I think it is a reasonable suggestion to say that parents should have options with their own tax money if their local school is closed and there are other options available to them, whether that be a charter school, whether that be another district school on a different part of the city, or whether it be a private school. So I think it's reasonable to say that state officials, so not the federal government, But state lawmakers should consider proposals to allow parents to choose how and where their children learn if a local school is closed and a parent feels like their child needs to be back in person. That's something for state lawmakers to take a hard look at. I'll close on this subject. Pennsylvania lawmakers are already considering such an idea. So I hope that we see more from state officials on that.
Well, turning to you, Scott Sargrad, on the question of reopening and the resources needed, because obviously, as we all said, everybody wants the children to go back to school for so many reasons. Parents have to get back to work. Women are particularly adversely affected by having the children at home, etc. But what about resources? Does the federal government, because President Trump is very adamant about schools reopening, do they have the power to punish school districts by withholding any funds? Or conversely, are they willing, because they want schools to open, are they willing to provide extra funds in order for safety procedures to be put in place, distancing, masks, et cetera?
So the short answer is that, as Jonathan said, no, the federal government does not have the power to withhold funds from school districts for refusing to reopen when it's not safe. There has been talk from the administration and from Republicans in Congress that they might want to condition any new aid on the physical reopening of schools or provide some sort of incentive to push schools to reopen. I think that is also a big mistake. It's pretty clear that every school district across the country has enormous needs for new resources, whether they're going to be reopening fully in person or in a hybrid model or in a fully virtual model. We know that because of the economic consequences of the pandemic, state budgets are looking at a $500, $550 billion shortfall over the next couple of years. And the federal government is the only entity that can step in and provide those kind of resources to shore up state and local budgets and make sure that we don't see massive cuts to education funding, massive layoffs of teachers, and massive reductions in services to students. So I think we've seen some estimates from a number of groups about some of the specific costs that are associated with the physical reopening of schools. The School Superintendents Association recently estimated that it would cost an average size district $1.8 million in additional funding just to implement some of the CDC guidelines on physical reopening. The American Federation of Teachers estimated nationally, that would be $118 billion. So there are really big needs here that were unexpected, obviously, before a global pandemic, and are the result of both the needs for physical reopening and just the needs for shoring up these budgets that have been decimated by the resulting recession.
We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are Scott Sargrad, Vice President of K-12 Education Policy at the Center for American Progress, from whom you just heard, and Jonathan Butcher, Senior Policy Analyst for the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Both organizations are based here in Washington, and they join me via Microsoft Teams as we continue to social distance. And we're discussing the pros and cons of reopening schools here in the United States as the coronavirus continues unabated. And this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out to a loyal fan, Alamin Mohammed from Mombasa, Kenya. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com, or better yet, like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to you, Jonathan, at the Heritage Foundation. I want to make one point that goes to both sides of the political aisle. President Trump keeps harping on China is at fault, the WHO for letting this virus get out of control, and we are the victims, that is the United States, of that. So that's one critique, and that's understandable, and yet we are where we are, and others say, you know, we should have done more. Instead of opening, let's say, tattoo parlors and bars, our focus should have been on, you know, getting our children back to school. So we have these historical ifs, if we had done this, if we had done that, but we are where we are. So let's take a look at how to go forward. Scott mentioned the resources that are needed. There's a bill pending, I believe, in the Senate that could provide states and local authorities with extra money that would be needed to retrofit schools to allow for spacing, masks, and so forth. Do you think that that would be an important step? And would Mr. Trump, in your view, be in favor of that?
Look, make no mistake, Washington makes significant investments and has over time in K-12 schools. We spend, on average, about $15,000 a year after adjusting for inflation on students around the U.S. A small portion of that, about 8.5%, comes from the federal government. That increase of what we spend on students has pretty much been unabated going back 50 plus years. There was a blip during the Great Recession, but nearly every state in the U.S. has recovered even from that. When you go back to the 70s, we're spending basically double what we were then after you adjust for inflation. Congress already has sent $13.2 billion to schools to deal with the pandemic. A small fraction of that has been spent right now. And so, look, if this was an urgent need, it's worth asking. We thought that meant urgent and that states were going to do something with those resources. So for one, it's a myth that schools are underfunded. And then for two, if we're going to talk about hundreds of billions in additional stimulus, well, let's ask what's been done with what's there already. A quick aside about the efficiency of spending in the U.S., New York State spends about double what is spent in South Carolina. And yet between 2000 and 2019, the math scores on a national indicator of South Carolina students far outpaced the gains of New York students. So before we start talking about piling more money in, let's talk about what are schools doing? How can we make it an effective experience for students?
Turning to you, Scott Sargrad, to respond, you indicated that there are shortfalls in state budgets. States cannot run deficits, I believe. But because of the pandemic, so many funds have been diverted. What's your view? Do you think that this bill that's pending in the Senate is necessary and well justified? Or, as Jonathan said, they haven't even spent, that is, the states haven't even spent some of the money they already got, and that they should be able to do this without additional funding?
The bill that is in the Senate is absolutely necessary, and I think it would go an incredibly long way to solving some of these challenges that we're both outlining in terms of the needs for reopening schools safely. I don't see how we can expect schools to reopen safely and implement all of these new measures that are part of the CDC's guidelines without new resources. Just taking, for example, the physical distancing requirements, how are schools supposed to have transportation for students on buses when they need to have 6 feet of space in between students? That can mean doubling or tripling the size of a bus fleet, which is an enormous expense. So I think it's very clear that schools need additional resources. It's very clear that the economic impact of the Great Recession on school funding and then ultimately on student achievement was enormous. I think research is now pretty clear that money does matter in education. And there's been a number of studies coming out of the Great Recession that showed that those spending cuts that happened had a significant negative impact on student learning and reading and math, and significant negative impacts on graduation rates. And so I think it's pretty clear that money does matter. Obviously, how you spend the money matters, but the evidence is now pretty certain on that.
Turning back to you, Jonathan Butcher, with regard to contingencies that may come up, let's say many schools decide to reopen for the reasons we all understand, the necessity of children getting back to the classroom. But what about if an emergency occurs? Let's say there's an outbreak, and of course we have older teachers who may have underlying conditions, and the difficulty of following national guidelines, which are meant to help everyone, you know, masks and distancing. It's possible that even classrooms will be so different that not all students can fit into a classroom. How do you see any kind of help from the federal government, which I know you're not a big fan of with respect to local schools, but shouldn't there be some kind of contingency planning? And if so, where is that supposed to come from?
Sure. Well, I think emergency plans should still come from local schools and local district officials. Look, I was talking to a charter school in Philadelphia last week, and they said that they plan to go back with half of their students in person, half online, Monday and Tuesday, clean the school Wednesday, and then do the other half in person Thursday, Friday with the students who were in class, now learning at home on Thursday and Friday. And that keeps a long stretch of students being away from their desks and away from in-person time with teachers. So there are clearly creative ways that schools are coming up with handling keeping educational content and contact with teachers front and center. And that's what was lost during the pandemic, especially in many of these urban areas that we've talked about, Los Angeles, Detroit, places like that. So there are best practices that schools can follow. I would say too that some of the private learning options that have been implemented in states around the US, like Arizona and North Carolina, some of the students using those options had the easiest time transitioning because they could use, in the case of North Carolina, education savings accounts where they could continue to pay an educational therapist, continue to use personal tutors to receive instruction, even as their school had been closed to in-person learning. So look, the ideas are out there. The good ideas that have been developed in states to help students succeed are there. And they can be done without additional stimulus from Washington.
What about that, Scott Sargrad, a hybrid model, some in-person classes, a mix of online instruction and in-person, as Jonathan outlined? How do you think that would work? And is that doable within the short period of time we have before schools would like to consider reopening?
I agree that schools need to be planning for all sorts of different options here. And they need to be planning for the safe return to in-person instruction based on conditions on the ground. They need to be planning for fully virtual options. There are a number of school districts that have already said they're going to have to begin the school year fully virtual, including Montgomery County Public Schools in Maryland, where my son is about to start kindergarten. So that means they also need to have these kind of hybrid options. Montgomery County, which is one of the largest school districts in the country, they have said that they're going to phase in this hybrid approach, similar to what Jonathan was saying for the charter school in Philadelphia, where students are going to be in class in person for 2 days a week with alternating schedules. Those are really challenging, and I think we shouldn't underestimate the shift that that requires for schools, for educators, and for families. In particular, if we're talking about virtual or hybrid options, there is an enormous digital divide in this country and a gap in connectivity for rural areas, for students from families with low incomes. It's millions of families that do not have access to reliable high-speed internet and do not have the devices to access remote learning. So again, this is an area where we need to have an additional investment. And there are bills in Congress, including the bill in the Senate, that would provide an additional $4 billion for connectivity and for devices. We can't have remote learning if students don't have the ability to access the internet and they don't have a device.
That's an interesting point, Jonathan. I know you're not a fan of using more federal funds for local school districts, but where else can localities find funds to supplement in this very difficult period, retrofitting their schools, allowing more online, given the digital divide that Scott underscored in our country, so that we don't reinforce already obvious inequities in our school districts across the country?
Well, school districts are, at the end of the day, in charge of their budgets, and they should be redirecting resources from areas where money is not being used now to the places where students need it. I think that parents should be asking their schools, hey, look, I mean, based on the evidence that we have, why are we keeping students out of the classroom? But there are some basic things of cleaning protocols and wearing masks, I think, that can help at least what I think we've found some agreement on here, do some sort of hybrid approach to get kids back.
I'm going to give you the last word, Scott.
I think there's clear consensus that the goal should be to safely start in-person instruction when that's possible in local communities. I think educators want to be back in the classroom. They want to see their students. Parents want their children back in classrooms. They want their children learning from their teachers in person. But there's also consensus that in most places across the country, it's not safe. And so we do need to invest in controlling the virus to begin with, and then we need to invest in helping schools and districts meet the guidelines to actually reopen safely. I think there's also consensus that in the interim, districts need to come up with plans in consultation with their communities, including families, including educators, on how to plan for these different contingencies. So whether that's starting the year fully virtual, starting with these hybrid models, figuring out how to get devices and access to students, and then planning for even once schools reopen in person, it's highly likely that in many places they're going to have to close again. We've seen what happens with this virus and moves so quickly and new hotspots come up all the time. They're going to need to plan for changes. And I think educators and school officials are looking to do that.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Scott Sargrad. He's vice president of K-12 education policy at the Center for American Progress, and Jonathan Butcher, senior policy analyst for the Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.